Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on Triangulation, I'm joined by Tom W. Bell. He's a professor of law at Chapman University Fowler School of Law and the author of the book Your Next Government: From the Nation State to Stateless Nations. We're going to talk about off-the-shelf government, big tech companies stepping into roles traditionally occupied by government, seasteading, and the future of cryptocurrency. All this and more next on Triangulation.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 384, recorded February 8th, 2019. Anarchy ahead. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hire qualified candidates the smart way and take your business to the next level. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for Triangulation. Our guest today on Triangulation is Tom W. Bell, author of a book about Your Next Government, From the Nation State to Stateless Nations. Tom is a professor at Chapman University School of Law, the Fowler School of Law there, where he's currently teaching all of the first year common law courses and electives in high tech and intellectual property law. So you're right up our alley here at Twit. We're thrilled to have you here, Tom. He's been at Chapman since 1998. Before that, he served as the policy director at the Cato Institute. And we're just thrilled to be able to have the opportunity to chat with you today, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Denise. Glad to be here.
So your book is a fascinating look at the future of government and posits that the government systems that we all love to hate will be forced to move to something more streamlined and more privatized, right? So could you give us kind of an overview of your thesis here?
Sure. The book, Your Next Government, I have a copy here too, describes this revolution, as I talk about in the book, that's transforming government all over the globe from the inside out and the bottom up. And those aren't just hand gestures. Those actually correspond to actual policies in the world. And it's fascinating. Lots of governments all over the planet have started setting aside little areas, sometimes big areas, of their countries where they say different rules apply here. We want to try something different. Usually it's in the line of lower taxes or lighter regulations. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But when it does work, the rest of us outside of the borders of these zones learn really useful lessons about public policy. And you get things like Dubai's International Financial Center, which has been a big success. And so I'm fascinated in this from a legal and policy point of view. And this book is all about the things I discovered and the work I've done for clients in the field. I basically work in the real world on this stuff as well as teaching. I have two jobs.
So you're keeping quite busy.
Yes.
Which we're glad of it. Tell us about your research for the book. Did you travel the world and visit some places like Dubai?
Didn't go to Dubai, but I did go to Honduras and French Polynesia. And I guess after the book came out, I went to the Republic of Georgia. That's for client work, although it's research too. When I go out and I work for clients, I'm learning things, which once I filter out the confidential stuff, ends up in the book or will end up in a future paper. So yeah, it's happening all over the world, and it takes you to interesting countries because it's not usually the countries that have governance totally nailed down. You're not going to go to Sweden probably and create a special economic zone there because they don't seem to need one. You end up going to places like Honduras, which has many virtues and charms, but good governance is perhaps not top of the list of the things in Honduras that is attracted to the country. And so, yeah, you end up going all over the world to some obscure corners.
So, first of all, I guess for folks who don't pay attention to what a special economic zone might be and why it's new and interesting, could you describe that for us?
Sure. Actually, the idea goes way back of some kind of special jurisdictions, all the way back to ancient Greece, or on Delos, I believe it was. They created a free port. But these days, special economic zones are more traditionally associated with things like free ports, foreign trade zones, which we have all throughout the United States, and then also places like Dubai's International Financial Center. Hong Kong, in a way, is kind of a special jurisdiction. It's called a special region in China. And as I said earlier, these are all areas where governments offer different rules, usually to foreign investors. Usually the goal is to draw in foreign investment. And the rules are usually financial, lower or no customs and duties, easier regulations, particularly in labor, if it's the kind of zone like a maquiladora where unfinished goods come in and they're finished and then shipped out again. And there's some other more radical experiments. Dubai's International Financial Center goes farther. Honduras, where I've done some work, goes very far. It's fascinating what they're doing in Honduras. Basically, they've empowered outsiders to create, with oversight, of course, completely private legal systems for the most part. The idea being that this will attract a certain collection of foreign investors, and they'll come to Honduras and improve things, create jobs, opportunities, and everybody will end up better off.
Let's go into that for a moment. You talk about it in your book, the notion of a private legal system. How does that work in practice?
Most of us actually are already very, very familiar with the fundamental component, and that is private arbitration. And whether we realize it or not, most of us are bound by lots of agreements that are not going to ever see the inside of a public court if there is a dispute. They'll go straight to private arbitration, and that'll kind of like settle the problem pretty quickly, and depending on who you talk to, fairly. In Honduras and other places, though, where they're opening up more areas for innovation, it goes beyond courts. This, too, is not uncommon, but it's not as well known. There are plenty of industries where essentially the regulation comes from within. There's industry codes and standards. They can even be enforced by private bodies. That's not uncommon. And if you think about it, really, all those are ways of making, enforcing, and adjudicating the law, and it all comes from private sources. We even have private sources for the sets of rules in the form of, say, for example, the American Law Institute or the Uniform Law Council, which together those two put out things like a Model Acts, and the ULC does uniform codes. Now, they're adopted by states in the United States, by individual states, and become binding law, but they issue from private bodies. So all these are examples of how the private sector is doing governance. It's providing government services, essentially. And when I look at the bigger picture of government, that's how I see it. It's a service industry. We have monopoly public providers, as we still have in some places in telecom and air travel. And then we have the private sector, which competes often, frankly, much better than the government in providing these services. They provide these services competitively because they have to. When you don't have a monopoly, you have to satisfy your customers. But so we see private and public governance services. That's what's happening in the world. And I'm working on the private side in part because I hope the innovation and competition on the private side of the governing services industry will inspire reforms on the public side. That's kind of my ultimate goal, is to improve government that we can't change too easily by making it face up to competition, make it step up its game so people who can't get up and move to better government will have better government where they live.
So we talked about dispute resolution as one form of privatized government function that we see in the world today in the United States and elsewhere. And as you point out, I mean, there is some controversy about whether it functions. Certainly there are ways in which it's more streamlined than our public dispute resolution system. But there are a lot of complaints about the fairness of it, the expense of it, the review process, if you should be unsatisfied with your result. So I would characterize it as an area, you know, in development and trying to innovate and trying to move forward and perhaps more able to do that than our public systems, which are fairly entrenched. But so dispute resolution is just one part of what government does. Can you describe for us some other aspects of government functions that you're seeing move to the private sector?
Sure. Well, I won't use present tense being moved, but I'll say has been moved to the private sector. That's security. There are many more private security officers in the United States than there are public police officers. And for many communities, that's about as much security as they want and need, and it suffices. Depends on the neighborhood you're in and your situation, but you could easily live in a condominium, which A big condominium, which is a city. A big condominium is effectively a private city. It's got its own fire protection system. It's got its own security system, you know, private guards. And it has its own transport system, public transport in the form of elevators and everything. It's basically a city in a building, and they have their own security malls. I don't need to go down the list. We all see these security guards. And that's just the start of it, of course. There's a lot of security provided through the private sector in a very advanced way that doesn't involve humans, cameras and sensors and all manner of things through which people secure their persons and property provided by the private sector. It's really what most people rely on. The police end up basically getting called after things go really badly. And maybe they hunt down the bad guys and throw them in jail. But actually providing security, not cleanup service, but making sure a bad thing doesn't happen, that's already handled by the private sector for the most part in the United States. It's different in other countries. Other countries are not as friendly. It depends on the country. But frequently, they're not as friendly to having private sector uniformed people running around and arresting people, because the private sector can arrest within limits. There is a common law right of arrest even to the private sector. So there's one. That's basically legal enforcement being done by the private sector. I don't see that trend stopping. I think it will continue, and I think it's probably a good thing. I already mentioned two. So if you think about the three branches of government, we covered judiciary, the executive branch, enforcement, and we might throw under that some regulations. I won't get into that. And then there's writing the legal rules. And again, we have private bodies like the American Law Institute and the Uniform Law Commission that make kind of rules for everybody. You go to the ALI, you can get the second restatement of contracts, and it tells you this is our generic contract law throughout all the common law jurisdictions. Or you can get much more specialized rules within specific industries. So, suppose you work in the pipeline business. I don't work in that field, but I'm assuming they have a number of standards and protocols and rules that to interface between networks, pipeline networks, you have to satisfy. Actually, I should stick to a network I know better, and that would be the internet, which is, again, it's a network, and there's a lot of interfacing going on, and that's basically all ironed out by people in usually like Marriott hotel rooms at conferences, guys in t-shirts and women in sneakers that in a very casual kind of way basically hammer out the infrastructure that we depend on that we're probably using right now, Denise. That's
absolutely we're sector. Using it now.
Yeah, that's private sector lawmaking.
Yeah. And you know what? This is the second episode of this show that I've hosted, Triangulation, where I felt compelled to bring up Professor Lawrence Lessig's book that I think is about 20 years old now, Code is Law. And I think that is kind of what you're getting at here, that the rules that we put into place just to streamline day-to-day functions of things like technology wind up being the rules that govern our lives, even though they have not been handed down from a governmental body. Do you agree?
No. You're right beside Larry Lessig. I have a history with him. I was actually in the first class he ever taught at the University of Chicago. Yeah,
I'm excited.
It was a great class. Yeah, it was fun to see him stretching his legs, learning how to be a professor. And he's done some great work. I admire his work immensely. But I think actually he has things exactly backwards in that book. When he says basically code is law, I think it's wrong. Because it fails to make a fundamental, crucial distinction between the coercive power of the state and the voluntary acceptance of rules in the private sector. This is a very common mistake. It's a sad one that has terrible ramifications in public policy. It's very common throughout academia and commentary at large to see a rule and assume all rules are the same. And I'm here to say that's a big mistake. And the difference is when the rule comes from the traditional form of government, the state, there's a gun behind it to enforce it. And that is simply not true of the rules that are regulating, for example, our exchange right now. No one says we have to use these rules right now using TCP/IP protocol. We choose it because it works. If we choose to use a conventional landline and we don't use packet switching to have our communication, no one will come and shoot us. Now, what Larry gets wrong is getting it reversed. He says code is law. That's wrong for reasons I just enumerated. But we can say in a way that law is code in the sense that laws in the sense of binding edicts that issue from authorities backed up by coercive force, those are algorithms. They are rules in the same way that algorithms help us write programs in Lisp or C++. And what you get from that is a number of interesting things, including the notion that, oh, there's nothing especially exalted about a rule that happens to issue from someone who's wearing a crown or has a badge, metaphorically speaking. They are all rules. And I think that helps take some of the wind out of the sails of people who want to say there's something, you know, more authoritative about this just because of the source. There may be reasons to obey those rules much more stringently than the rules that come from the private sector, but it's not just because it's automatically better or more powerful because it comes from the state.
Does it change your analysis at all if we throw into the mix what you mentioned a moment ago, that not only are the rules and the processes being privatized, but the enforcement, that there's more private sector security. We, of course, have private sector military subcontractors that get brought in to help wage war. Does that shift things at all?
I think it certainly raises questions, and everyone should get worried whenever they see, you know, one person standing over another, hitting them with a baton. That could be justified, but when people are crying out in pain, it deserves investigation. However, let's just observe, if they're playing by the rules, to use an example from the United States, private security guards are acting within the bounds of the law. As I said earlier, if you're a private security guard at a mall, you can detain someone for shoplifting. And if you overstep your bounds, of course, you'll be charged with unlawful imprisonment, which is a tort, and you'll suffer a lawsuit. There might be criminal sanctions. But every one of us actually has the power to arrest malefactors. We have the power of citizen's arrest. That's okay, as long as we do it within the bounds established by what? The ultimate authority in a political system, which is, again, the people empowered through the electoral process to wield guns to enforce the rules that in some way we, I'm going to use scare quotes because it's a system, but, you know, the people choose.
Beatmaster in IRC is watching live with us and mentions privatized prisons, another good area to discuss of functions that are already traditionally government functions that are being more and more subcontracted out to the private sector. If anyone's ever watched Orange is the New Black, you can know the various problems that they've highlighted there in the privatized prison system. What's your take on that aspect of privatized government, Tom?
We're getting a little far from the things I can talk about with much knowledge. I will confess, I'm a law guy and I don't do criminal law, in part because I find it extraordinarily distasteful. I find most criminal law, you know, just badly run. And a lot of things that are criminalized shouldn't be. And I've just kind of turned up my nose to the whole thing. But I will say about private prisons, I don't think the fact that they're private should sort of prima facie make it any worse. It's not better to have solitary confinement done by somebody with a badge. It still hurts the prisoner just as much as if it's done by a state authority. So we should evaluate these different institutions on their merits. And honestly, I don't know the answer. I am convinced there have been some abuses by private prisons. I have no doubt about that. Some horrible stories. But of course, that's true of the government prisons too. One of the biggest things I worry about with private prisons is it creates an incentive structure, really, by basically funding this industry that is now going to go and has gone to legislatures and said, hey, you know, this, for example, this decriminalization of marijuana thing is not really what Californians want, is it really? And what they're thinking of is we won't have as many paying customers or clients if you don't bust a bunch of dope heads and throw them in jail. And that's terrible. We don't want people lobbying for laws that will affect all of us just to line their pockets. But again, the prison guards union, which gets money from the state of California, also lobbies against things like decriminalization of marijuana. So I think I don't see an angel or a devil attached to either of these labels, government or private, in this zone. I will say a nice thing about having private prisons in the mix is it provides some competition. It provides us with choices. If we find out that when California sends some prisoners out of state because of complicated bad reasons, but we might discover, oh, they're sending them to private prisons in Arizona and Nevada and different states, and we might be able to say, oh, you know, this private prison is not as good. Let's not use them anymore. You can't really do that with California's prisons. If you end up stuck in a California public prison, you can't easily say, you know, oh, I don't like this. Let's have, you know, the populace can't say, let's get rid of those prison guards who are brutal. It's very difficult. With the private sector, it's easier to just kind of throw a switch, throw them out, say, you guys don't do a good job. We're going to find somebody who does it better. And if they might not do it better, but we can get rid of them too. And eventually, through competition, I like to think we're more likely to get a better system if the private sector is in the mix.
So one of the things that occurred to me a moment ago as we were talking about all of these various aspects and areas where government is becoming more a function of the private sector is the role that artificial intelligence is bound to play in all of this. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on all that.
I don't have a lot of big thoughts, capital T with an S, but I'll offer you one thought. Again, not really my area of expertise. I do high tech law, but in the law, I don't think AI is doing as much as people think it could or should. Probably will someday. So anyhow, the idea is simply, again, to look at the structural feature. If AI has something to offer us in making government better, I think it's highly possible. AI already does serve us in a lot of kind of low-key ways, in ways that we don't notice. Then it will be better to have a system where governments have to compete to ensure that these latest innovations serve the public interest. Suppose, for example, we're in the old Soviet Union. It still survived. You know, it's still around, but or maybe it's like North Korea. Yeah, we'll use North Korea. It's basically another totalitarian communist state that, alas, still survives. So is suppose AI is really great at doing things like laying out roads and, I don't know, detecting criminal activity, things like that. North Korea is going to be probably the last country in the world to use that AI in ways that help its population. They might use it in ways to further hurt their population. But they're not going to be stimulated. They're not going to be forced through competition in North Korea to make their citizens' lives better by using this latest technological tool. And I think it's much more likely to happen in areas where there's either private governance, where the private governments have to compete, or you have a public government that is competing with private governments.
So go into your research and writing in the book and give us some examples of interesting ways this is playing out.
Sure. Well, let's talk about the Honduran case, because Honduras takes us right to the forefront, to the kind of frontier of lawmaking in this area. Honduras is a country in Central America. It's rather obscure to most Americans. If they've heard of it, it's probably in some very sad news. Honduras for a long time had the dubious distinction of being the murder capital of the world. The highest murder rates were in Honduras, in certain cities in Honduras. It's all because of the drug trade, for which we can blame United States policy, basically. I won't get into that. I just want to say, go easy on the Hondurans. Their woes have largely been imported. Nonetheless, it's not a happy place in many respects. However, they've had a lot of success. One of the few bright spots, really, in their recent history has been their export processing zones. These are special jurisdictions where they have had companies come into Honduras and build factories and hire locals to process. Usually it's garment parts that come in and they'll like say sew them together and then ship them out again finished to markets like the United States. And this the reassurance of a special structure in which to operate encouraged investors to come to Honduras. They have skilled labor, at least at that level, in plenty. And it worked out great. And so Honduras thought, well, we still have a lot of problems in this country. Let's take this good idea that's working for us and see how far we can take it. I've actually met the author of their program, and he is a Honduran, and I admire him so much. He's a fellow who, even when he was a young man, started thinking about ways he could improve his country. And when he joined government service, I'm talking about Octavio Sanchez, he's talked about in the book, he looked at Hong Kong, and he said, why can't we have a Hong Kong in Central America? And that's what he set out, he and some other reformers in the government there, to create. And they created first, it was called the Red Program, and that was thrown out as unconstitutional. And in most countries, you'd say, well, you know, that's not going to work. And they said that in Honduras, but they didn't give up. They went back and they amended the Constitution. Now, it's a little easier to do that in Honduras than it is in America, but still, it shows they really wanted this to happen. And now they have, they put into place the ZEDE program, Z-E-D-E, and that's in force now. And on paper, now there's no officially opened ZEDE yet. It's been only a few years, and these things take time. But when and if a ZEDE starts operating, you will see there private, local and foreign investors who will be creating a system of governance with the idea that it will attract investment from and residents and workers from abroad, skilled workers and teachers and doctors, and they'll come to this zone, this kind of nascent Hong Kong in Central America. And just as Hong Kong has had these wonderful effects in surrounding areas, look at Sichuan, right? That's all Shenzhen, and that's basically kind of spillover from Hong Kong. Wow, if they could get that in Honduras, it'd make things so much better. And so the ZEDE is going to have basically authority under the amended constitution and the comprehensive statute, the ZEDE legislation, to effectively pass its own laws in almost all areas except, so it's easier to say, here are the things they can't legislate on than it is to go through the long list of things they can do. I mean, they can't have their own financial regime. They do have to have some taxes at a certain level, but their taxes are also capped. And but they can do their own contract law, their own tort law, own regulations of industries, their own labor code in the ZEDE. Now, there's oversight by the Honduran officials. Well, actually, it's better than that. They created kind of a trust to kind of create a buffer between the government and this private development. They've created kind of an intermediary body. It's called the CAMP. It's like a board of trustees, you might say, which, pursuant to the statute, keeps an eye on the ZEDE, you know, watches it, will watch it and look for human rights violations, for violations of fundamental rights that are actionable under the Constitution of Honduras, which remains in force, and under international law. If there are human rights violations in one of these ZEDEs, the ultimate appeal is not even to Honduras. It goes to an international court for the protection of human rights. That's better protection than most countries offer, right? In most countries, you go up to the Supreme Court and you're done. And here are the areas where you can't legislate in the ZEDE. You can't, of course, have your own flag, national anthem. You can't do your own treaty negotiations with other countries. You don't get to act like a full-blown sovereign because you're not. And these are matters of national dignity, which even the Hondurans care about. And also, you can't have your own criminal code. You can't, for example, decide, oh, marijuana is legalized here. The Hondurans actually are not big fans of decriminalizing drugs. However, I will say for them, in certain, if you do it right, prostitution and gambling is legal in certain ways in Honduras. In a lot of ways, it's more liberal than the United States in that regard. But the point is, because criminal law embodies moral values, which the Hondurans have legislated on, is that they can't change that. Well, actually, they can change it, but they have to get the approval of the National Assembly if they pass their own criminal code. But, and here's the crucial thing, Denise, the ZEDE can enforce the criminal laws itself. It has its own police force, its own criminal courts, its own prisons. And if you know anything about the Honduran criminal justice system, at this point you go, that's a relief. A lot of the laws in the books look awesome. The problem with Honduras is not that they've written bad laws. The problem is that, unlike the code that runs computers, the code that runs governments requires humans to implement it. And in Honduras, some of those humans have not followed the rules that they themselves have written down. That's common in a lot of countries, but Honduras has had particular problems.
Wow, that seems really interesting and will be fascinating to watch as these ZEDEs unfold. Because, of course, Honduras has – you've been there. I haven't. But from my understanding and just, you know, surfing the web and being actually a somewhat enthusiastic scuba diver, I know that Honduras it could be a zone and already is a zone where a lot of people from other countries want to come just because of the beauty of its natural resources and the things that you can travel there to do and see. So tourism could be, you know, a huge boon to that country if it could get over its sort of reputational problems, and people would feel safe and comfortable going there routinely, which it sounds like these ZAs want to facilitate.
Oh, absolutely. Same time zone as Chicago. It's like having paradise in your backyard is what we're aiming for. And you mentioned tourism. You're right, by the way. I've been to some of the most beautiful spots of Honduras, and they are among the most beautiful spots in the world. And I've been diving there, and it's just great. Roatan has these wonderful reefs, and they've done a great job of protecting them, too. They were one of the leading places to say, get that sunscreen off our coral, because they saw it was bad, and they really need to protect their coral. But you mentioned tourism. Let's throw in there with a ZA, you can do medical tourism. Because guess what? You get to do your own medical regulations. No, this doesn't mean you're going to be grafting dogs' heads on cats, right? I mean, there's
Thank
limits.
Goodness.
There's
but yes,
be limits.
There are many, many people in the world, including the United States, who would like to find quality medical care that costs less.
Exactly. And that's what we hope the ZAs can offer. Fly down there, go diving, get an operation you can't get thanks to the FDA. Do some more diving, come back home. That'd be great.
Wow. I've never organized a dive trip around my surgical needs before, but
I'm not speaking as a medical professional, actually. I'm not sure that would work.
Maybe
hike the jungle.
Yes, maybe we're gazing into the future. Okay, so we've talked about Honduras. Where else have you gone in the world or looked at in the world that's doing some interesting things?
Oh, gosh. There's a lot of stories in the book about these sorts of things, and it's in a chapter called Stories of the Sort Ordinarily Recounted Over Drinks.
Perfect.
Because it's the place in the book where I get to kind of just tell these stories. When you're asked, and I say, read the book, there it is again. It's everybody's favorite chapter is that chapter. But I'll tell you some curious things that have happened. French Polynesia. Actually, I'll update the book. So in the book, I talk about going to French Polynesia, that island paradise smack dab in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's one of the most remote places on Earth. And I went there with the Seasteading Institute to talk with government officials about creating a seastead in that island nation, in a protected atoll. And the idea was, and I'm afraid here, Denise, I have to use the past tense, but the idea was to create a sea zone. The first time we'd done this, where we'd have a land-based, relatively small anchor zone, and most of the zone in these protected waters where the seasteaders would build the floating platforms, is what seasteading is all about, where people could live and work. Because the seasteaders ultimately want to create sovereign floating homes, cities really, on the open ocean. That's a long way off. That's the goal. But as an intermediary step, they reasoned, both for engineering and legal reasons, we need protected waters. We need protected waters for engineering reasons because, it's just hard to build stuff on the open ocean when you have a lot of waves. So let's get the technology ironed out in nice, safe, warm waters. And an atoll's great. But there's also a lot of legal engineering questions. I'm kind of like a legal engineer, as I think of myself. I know I go in and I tinker with code and fix things. And, someone comes to me and says, we need a government for the open ocean. I'm like, okay, I can't be dumb, but that's like asking a coder, build me an operating system from scratch. You say, it's going to take a while, and I can't promise the first run will be smooth. But if you do it through a zone, the idea is you wouldn't have complete sovereignty. You wouldn't have to worry about your national defense and pirates at first, things like that. And you could iron out the less crucial things like contract law and dispute resolution. And so anyhow, that was the pitch, and we made it. And the good news is, the happy news is, we got what we wanted on that trip. That trip was, I think, 2016, 15. And we said, hey, can we get a memorandum of understanding with you, French Polynesia, to take steps towards this? And they said yes. And we did, and it was great. We had a wonderful year working with them. But at the end of it, we were hoping to get legislation, and it never came. But let me follow up. So that's where the book ended at. We're waiting for the legislation. And I got to say, it never came. And there are some diehards who say, or we still have some friends. And we have lots of friends in French Polynesia who still want to make it happen. But they got to get the government on board. And for complicated local, political, and international reasons, because France is involved. Basically, they're somewhat under the thumb of France in French Polynesia. It's complicated. It's a complicated install, as I like to say, as a law coding guy. It's a complicated install. You don't have a clean slate. You don't have a bare metal install.
Right.
But there's some diehards there who say, we're still working on it. But I'll tell you, the action is now in Thailand. I have a friend, Chad Elwartowski, who runs now Ocean Builders. Chad Elwartowski, he He runs Ocean Builders, and that guy, my friend, has built a seastead. He just went and did it. It's floating off the shore of his new home. I believe he married. He's got a wonderful Thai woman, his wife. I think they're a couple anyhow. And so he lives in Thailand. And Chad's one of the many wonderful people I've met, a libertarian-minded, kind of irascible, stubborn, wonderful, brilliant people who made a lot of money in cryptocurrency. You know, bless his heart. He's going to spend it on what he cares about and what I care about, too. And he built a seastead. You can go to his Ocean Builders and see he's out there with his probably his spouse right now. And they just built it. They only put it in the water like, I don't know, a week ago. They only moved in. It's so exciting. So, again, we're seeing the cutting edge. People are actually – no. Chad has not come back to me and said, Tom, we need the legal system because it's just him and his loved one. He's doing the engineering. But he's going to offer these, he says, at the price of kind of an average family home. So for that price, you get what is – a small house floating on – it's an interesting structure. It's not a boat. It's like a long pipe that sits deep in the water so the waves don't make it rock. When you see this thing, it looks like it's set on land more or less. It moves a little. But you'll see waves under it moving around, and it's sitting on this big pipe or pillar that goes deep underwater. Excellent.
Wow.
There
wow.
you go.
If you're watching the video, we're showing the seastead site yep. here, Ocean Builders.
Yep.
So that I just amazing. Loved
it. He said he kind of flipped there. That's projected. But that's how it's going to happen, I think. People are going to wow. say, I want to do it too. And they'll set up next to Chad and he might say, you're a little too close. And eventually, but there'll be communities. And they're going to – I tell you, Denise, I believe someday my friends are going to come back to me and say, Tom, we got a dispute. we need right. some rules here. And I said, well, you came to the right guy. I'm here to help.
So is the vision of this that it's going to be sort of like a housing development or more like a country or both?
I think it'll start like a housing development. He went a little bit out offshore from Thailand's territorial claims, but it's complicated. There's a chapter in the book about this too. There's a whole chapter about seasteading. There's complicated issues no matter where you are in the ocean with vessels and sovereignty, and these will probably be classified as vessels under international law. And if he stays, so if he's going to have sovereigns impacting his behavior, no matter where he is, Chad. And as soon as he gets other people involved, it'll begin like a homeowners association conflict. But as it grows, it'll become a much more general issue. And at some point, what we hope to have are self-flagging seasteads. The idea is the way we were going to do it, I don't actually know what Chad plans on the kind of legal political front. I don't think he cares. I think Chad says, I'm just going to build it. I'm just going to build it and do it and worry about permission later.
Did he look at shipping channels and things before he decided where to build it?
Yeah, yeah. He's an engineer. So he doesn't want like hard stuff to hit him. But yeah. As far as like filling out a bunch of paperwork I don't think he's doing anything foolish. He chose a place where it's in a bay, basically. He often talks about how the waters never get above 2 meters, and he's got all this historical data, and he checked currents and everything. But he, I'm sure he also looked into whether or not there's a lot of piracy. I'm sure it's not in a shipping lane. I've already seen some video. It looks actually peaceful. They had some dolphins actually off their back door not long ago. So it looks like a really great place, both, well, so far, I'll say legally and politically, because he hasn't been arrested yet. I don't think he's doing anything wrong. He's kind of out of the way.
Yet in. Yeah. It's wonderful and delightful, and it reminds me of shows that I've done in the past about space law and how that will develop, because it seems somewhat reminiscent of going to the moon or Mars and building your little flock of domes and putting people in them and wondering what's going to happen and how they're all going to interact.
But see, we don't have to wonder, Denise. That's the beauty of seasteading. We'll get to try out these rule systems, these social structures, in an environment which is socially, you know, kind of like space. These will be isolated, artificial homes, relatively isolated. And we're going to need rules out there. And there will be some kind of ties with, you know, they'll be flagged, flying the flags of countries or maybe seasteading flags. So there'll be some interplay, but basically, we'll figure out there on the oceans first. And then I think what we'll see is we'll just take those rules and slap them on a spacecraft and say, on Mars, it'll be pretty much the same. And on Route 2, it'll be like the rules for communities on the open ocean, except you'll be in open space.
Right. I'm just curious, because this Ocean Builders thing is so fascinating. Do you know any details of how they're doing infrastructure. I'm sure they don't want to, you know, pollute the waters around them. I'm sure they probably have some sort of trash and sewage designed into their plans. Do you know anything about that?
Because I'm not like a physical engineer, just a legal engineer, I haven't looked into that. I agree it is fascinating. I know they have a, you know, water system on the seastead. I guess they have to. And I'll just say interested readers should follow up and go to Ocean Builders see what Chad says there. I don't know if he has the blueprints. I just haven't looked at it yet. It's so new. And I got two jobs, so I'm kind of busy.
All right. Anything else from the stories we tell over drinks that you want to throw in before we move on to some other topics?
Well, really, I'd love to talk about that all day. So I'll just say here are two other, two more areas that are happening. Okay, so one is after the book, and that's the Republic of Georgia. And I'll just say after the book came out, I went to the Republic of Georgia and talked to some wonderful people there about a wonderful project called the Anaklia, A-N-A-K-L-I-A, Freeport. And if they follow through on their plans, it will be like ZA-grade independence. And that's a very exciting part of the country. It's on the China Belt and Road system. It's actually kind of on a byway, but with Anaklia, it could become a big part of that. And they don't even need the Chinese belt and a road system for this to be a big success. So anyhow, Anaklia, look at that. And then also Liberland. There's a little bit in that chapter about Liberland, which is always worth a smile. I was going to say laugh, but I don't want you to think it's a joke. But it's just a funny, crazy thing they're trying to do in between Croatia and Serbia to create a new country in this little swampy area down by the Danube. There's some stories in the book about it, which are funny and also kind of reveal some unpleasant things about the way governments work, as if you need another story.
Who's the they? Who's trying to build Liberland?
The Liberlanders, of course, but the head of them is a wonderful guy, Vít Jedlinka, who was a Libertarian Party representative in Czech Republic. And Vít discovered there was this little portion down of country next to the Danube, which neither the two countries, for complicated Balkan reasons, wanted to claim. They both kind of turned up their noses at this little bend in the river that it was inside kind of an oxbow. And because of its situation on the river, it was unclear who owned it. And both parties said, not me either. So Vít said, me. He actually wasn't the first. It's a complicated story, but he's the most notorious of the parties who went there and planted flags and said, nobody else, no nation state wants it. We'll take it. And under international law, he's got a valid claim. I actually wrote up some stuff, which I think he's used about how, you know, here's some arguments. You got a good argument. But arguments, for all their, you know, beauty on paper, don't determine what happens in international relations. And Croatia has proven – Serbia is quite happy to have all this happen. They're actually laughing at Croatia, I think. But Croatia is somewhat flustered by this. They don't like it. They said they don't want that area, but they also really don't want Vít and company there. And so they've done some things which I think are blatantly illegal, and we did litigation over it. And, oh, it's a mess. But anyhow, it's Vít has not given up. I just read news. So everyone should check in on Liberland if you're interested in that. There's some stuff happening there. They just bought some property, I think, on the Serbian side of the river, and they're running now a hotel. And the idea is they're doing something there. They have not given up, and someday there might actually be their flags sticking in the soil there and a hotel and a resort and a Las Vegas / Hong Kong, Dubai, maybe.
And again, so the idea is if they actually can pull that off, this evolution in government that you've written about would enable them to sort of wholesale bring in governmental systems and structures and policies and procedures that they could sort of buy off the shelf.
Yeah, Denise, you used two words here I really like. One was evolution. I think it's a really useful metaphor here. And what we're seeing is we're entering this kind of Cambrian explosion era in governance, because we got all these little critters now running around. There's like over, on some counts, 10,000 of these special jurisdictions in the world today. You look at a map and you see like big country and a solid line around it, and it's just not the way the world is. It's got all this stuff going on. And out of that, we're going to see competition and evolution, and we're going to get if we do it right, a lot better government. And the other thing you said was you kind of you made this kind of, I don't exactly, what was the word you use, something like a download or, but the idea is that we're going to set up these jurisdictions. We're moving in government the way that we've moved in computers, from big mainframes with custom OSs to lots and lots and lots and lots of computers running operating systems that you can take from one to the other. Just like there's kind of common law countries that kind of run on the same OS, you know, England and Canada and Singapore, they all use the common law. I think we're going to see more of that in a much more really obviously like Windows or Apple's OS kind of examples. We're going to have, this is happening in Honduras, we're going to have jurisdictions where they say, hey, we're going to download the best rules. And then some other jurisdiction is going to say, those are really good rules. We want to download those too. And then, Denise, the really exciting thing will happen, kind of this internet of governments. This is I talk about in the last chapter of the book, which is all about where we headed. Same place computers have taken us, but more slowly, because governments move more slowly than computers. Why? Because code is code. Larry Lessig was right in that formulation. Code is code. He kind of got it reversed in the way you talk about that. But what we've done with computer code, we can and should do with government code. And that means we should have an operating system like ULEX, I'm working on this, which is open source and anyone can use. And it'll allow people to have really good rules. Everyone will have like a good interface with their government and will allow these jurisdictions running the same OS to interface. And that'll create a network. And then you'll have like an archipelago of jurisdictions all running the same open source legal system. And that'll be a really good thing, a golden swan, as I call it. Everybody talks about black swans. I believe those exist, but we should also take note of golden swans, and I believe that's where this book ends up, on a golden swan.
So the notion there, too, if different governments are running sort of an off-the-shelf kind of legal system, governmental policies, then having laws apply cross-jurisdictionally, it seems like that would be much easier.
Yes, it was off the shelf. Yeah, that was the phrase you used. Yeah. That's a good phrase here. Yeah, off the shelf. And when I created ULEX, that's kind of how I viewed it. You know, ULEX is this open source legal system created for special jurisdictions that is flag free. It's all from private sources like the American Law Institute or the Uniform Law Council Commission. And I pictured myself with a basket walking into a library and saying, oh, I need some contract laws from a private source. Oh. Second restatement of contracts, ALI, perfect. Off the shelf, just like you said, Denise. And I need tort law. There we go, restatements. And I just filled up my basket to do some organization. But you end up with basically the kernel of an operating system for government. It's just the kernel, like the Linux kernel at the heart of the Android operating system. That's the most common OS in the world today. Anyhow, but we're talking about ULEX and you might have some other things. We got lots of things we can talk about. We can talk about blockchain. We can talk about Facebook's online governance, whatever you want, Denise.
We will, and we can, and we are going to. And right now, I think what we'll do before we get into that is thank our sponsor for this episode of Triangulation, which is ZipRecruiter. Tom has been talking about things that can be a big mess. You know what's not a mess, and you know what's smart. Using ZipRecruiter to help you either become employed or fill your employment needs. Job boards that send you to a mile-high stack of resumes for candidates that aren't qualified for the role you posted, it's not smart going that way. What is smart is going to ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation to hire just the right person for the role you need. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes to identify people with the skills, education, and experience that you need. It actively invites them to apply to your job so you get qualified candidates fast. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. So right now, Triangulation users can try ZipRecruiter for free at our exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. You should show your support for this show and for ZipRecruiter by going to ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. That's ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Thank you so much, ZipRecruiter, for your support of TWIT and Triangulation. So, Tom, I guess one follow-up before we go into those next topics that you just teased. And that is, you talked about ULEX, this open source government structure that you have developed and made available. You talked about it as a kernel. And I guess my follow-up question is, the government structures that we see traditionally develop and evolve over time, they're tinkered with by legislatures and courts. How will that process work with a ULEX type government?
Happy to address that. And by the way, your mention of your sponsor, which sounds awesome, ZipRecruiters, but I want to mention I'm not speaking on behalf of any client here, just to clarify that.
Yes.
Just talking for myself. ULEX basically provides a set of substantive rules for regulating conduct of people in a system, and that includes rules for adjudicating disputes. But it won't give you things like, for example, it doesn't have a police code of conduct. It does say, you know, hey, police, you can't commit torts against people because we define torts and we don't want you to do that. But to run a police system, you need all kinds of policies, for example. Also, it doesn't create an executive to run a jurisdiction. It doesn't have really a way for judges to be nominated. You need more. It's just a kernel. It's the part of a governing system where you look at the law books and you need something there. But there's much more to government. So how do you do that other stuff? ULEX doesn't tell you that. Now, I, of course, have ideas, and some of those ideas are expressed in the book. I have chapters where I talk about general principles of governance that I think if we go out in the field and we kind of look around at what's going on, we can distill from those observations, oh, this is the way people who run systems that work run things. And I also offer some very specific kind of, you know, you should do this if you're running a government. If I have anything to say about it, I'm going to tell you, do this. And one thing, by the way, Denise, is, speaking of cops and committing torts, is getting rid of governmental immunity. I am very much against it. I have a chapter called Against Governmental Immunity. It's in the news now. Supreme Court is adjudicating what to me is kind of a very easy minor call, and that is a qualified immunity. Qualified, there should be no immunity at all. But anyhow, I'll say in direct answer to your question, good question. But building the whole system of governance, I have ideas about that, some of which I've shared, but ULEX doesn't answer that. That's like you go to the other coders and you ask them to build that part of the system.
Got it. Okay, well, we've been discussing your premise that nation states are facing competition. They're facing competition, you write in your book, from such entities as private cities, self-legislating special economic zones that we've been discussing, and other agile new institutions. And I guess I wanted to get into what some of those other institutions might be, such as private tech companies. Two things I wanted to hit on here. Number one is this ongoing series that Cash Hill has been doing about trying to extricate yourself from the technological systems that you might be using. Specifically, we'll put in the discussion points today a piece at WBUR, which I believe is a public radio station, more than just blocking Facebook. It's called Can We Live Without Big Tech? And they did an interview with Cash and sort of went into her pieces on this point. How do you disengage? And I guess the overarching point of this exercise is that these institutions have become such a part of our life and we've become so reliant on them that they're undertaking some of the roles that traditionally we might have allocated to government. And I guess the footnote to that is this notion that Facebook is going to start doing dispute resolution on its platform in what's been referred to as the Supreme Court of Facebook, where it has a sort of non-Facebook related entity that is going to be adjudicating disputes about, say, speech on the site, whether something should stay up or down on the site, and make that determination in a way that sort of hopefully will give the users some satisfaction that their claims have been adjudicated fairly, and also will somewhat shield Facebook from this notion that they are in control of what is acceptable speech and not acceptable speech on their platform. So I'm wondering, Tom, what you think about private entities starting to fill more of these roles.
Sure. As I think you mentioned at the beginning, I have both an academic and a kind of professional part of my life. And so for the last several years, outside entities have come to Chapman University and said, hey, the Bell guys are doing interesting work. Can you come work for us? And then I'm a little bit like an engineer, you know, who specializes in bridges. You might get hired to go build some special bridge. And the university works it out, and basically they have me work for them part-time, and then I still teach also. So I say all this because in recent years, I've been working with these high-tech firms that are creating communities on the internet, we'll say, you know, virtual communities. And I've discovered it's a lot easier than working with meat space governments. It's a lot easier because you just have to write the code more or less and hit, you know, send or upload. So that's wonderful. And increasingly, you can do, you can do really important stuff online. Huh? That's really understating it. For many of us, as your reference to Cash's work indicates, the most important parts of our lives are online. I have a new book chapter coming out called The Forecast for Anarchy. I don't really like that word so much, but that's in the title of the book, and I got to use it. But in that chapter, I describe a scenario where effectively it's not just special jurisdictions in the real world that end up competing for governments and improving governments and basically giving us an option, but rather governments in the virtual world. And increasing parts of our lives are going to be moved to that world, and they will be out of the reach of real space governments. And that's going to make real space governments, in the long run, it's going to make them, to recur to an earlier theme, rather like dinosaurs in a world where now there's mammals. Now, I know you're immediately thinking, oh, the dinosaurs are going to go extinct, but that's not what happened to dinosaurs, really. They evolved, too. They evolved into birds. And if I have to live in a world with dinosaurs or birds, I'm going for the birds. Birds are fun. They're charming. They're useful. They're harmless. They don't kill millions, whereas dinosaur-sized governments do. So this uploading of governance is great. I'm super happy to work in that field. And now we'll talk about some of the issues you raised. Are you ready for that, Denise? You want to talk do you want to talk about Facebook or Denise? You said her name is Cash?
Cash Hill. Her piece was about trying to extricate yourself from these systems that have become so much a part of our lives. And she's had a difficult time doing that and has documented it.
All right, I'll say something about that recurs to special jurisdictions. So imagine I'm trying to do this here. I could use the dry erase board, but I'm wired in. Imagine these are people in a society. These are people like you and me. And we use the internet. These are people in our society, our network society. And we're kind of under the aegis, as it were, of Amazon in particular. Her stories are really kind of scary. I'm a tech guy. I read a lot of this stuff. But her story about how getting Amazon out of your life is so difficult kind of alarmed me. So we're kind of under the aegis. That's the wrong word. Aegis means protective. We have a lot of Amazon in our lives, all of us. We're not really – it's hard to get away from Amazon. You got to – if you leave this, you know, area and you say, I want to be outside Amazon, you end up outside of the world where all your friends and the activity is, and that's no good either. So maybe what we need – just occurs to me in our conversation today. I can see special jurisdictions doing this, and this comes from my work in French Polynesia, because when you're in French Polynesia, you can't help but note how wonderful it is to set down your cell phone and dig your toes in the sand and relax. And it's not like I'm coming up with this idea right now, because I was there with a lot of wonderful people who became close friends, and we just spoke about the world we foresaw living in French Polynesia on a seastead. And a lot of it was very low tech. And so the idea I have here is maybe what we need is an institution like a special information zone. And we go inside it and we're protected in the sense that we don't have to interface with Amazon there. We put down our cell phones. You could even have a rule, no recording here. This is where people are just going to live for a while. Now you're thinking, oh yeah, that's a beautiful dream, but people can't live like that day to day. Well, the idea is if you can't do that in our world. For us, it's like vacation. You go to Belize, you go to Honduras, you go to Rotan, Honduras, a wonderful place to vacation. Wonderful. So safe. They even speak English there. Yes. But you go to Rotan, Honduras for 2 days. For 2 days, you can put down your phone and you come back and there's a ton of email and you got to go back on Amazon and order the groceries and everything else. No, I'm imagining we create an institution which interfaces for people and says basically, you don't need an identity on Amazon. We got you covered. We know that you need these many eggs and you like that kind of skirt, and we're going to see to that. And all in Amazon will see, thanks to the buffer we provide, is that big unit over there, again ordered, 2,000 eggs. And Amazon won't know where it's going. They don't know that you like eggs and I don't. So it's just an idea for you, which the more I think about it, the better it sounds. But ask me tomorrow.
Right. So I think what you're sort of mapping out, a lot of people have been thinking about, you know, ways in which there would be trusted third parties that you entrust with your data that then interact with larger entities like social media or e-commerce sites. Yes. So you've got an aspect of that in there, and also an aspect of a private government system that would be, that maybe would be that third party trusted entity, and that would house that data. And because it had, you know, a group of people that were all participating, it would further, I don't know, I suppose it would have bargaining power because of the volume of people that it represented. Perhaps it would have better capability of anonymizing and protecting data. I don't know. It's an interesting concept. I've definitely been paying attention over the years to people who want private, trusted third parties to be the data interface, but I've never really thought about integrating that with a private government system as well. So that's a really interesting concept that you just mapped out on your legal pad there, Tom. And so okay. what do you think about Facebook as a Facebook, again, sort of offshoring and subcontracting out this dispute resolution system that would govern disputes that arise on the platform?
Well, I'm not ashamed to say I have a soundbite for you on that. And okay. Here it is. Facebook is not setting a precedent. They are finally following the precedents. When you think about how important Facebook is to some people, some people's businesses, how they have it integrated into their economic well-being, or if it's like an organization, a political organization, a religious organization, an activist organization, and Facebook walks in and shuts these things down, they are powerfully impacting people's lives. And not only do they know that at Facebook, they want it. They want people to integrate Facebook in their lives and rely on it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So far, so good. I got no problem with that. I use Facebook. I use it a lot. I like it. Does a number of good things for me. But when you have an interface with another party, another institution, and you have a dispute with it, you don't let either party settle the dispute. If I have a contract with Hertz Rent-A-Car and it has a clause, and they try this, I mean, this is clown lawyering, and they have a clause that says, if you have a dispute with Hertz Rent-A-Car, it goes to private arbitration. I read that and I go, oh, okay. And the dispute will be decided by a panel of Hertz's CEO, CFO, and COO, their executive officers. That's a joke. And no other court would enforce that. If I go sue Hertz, by the way, nothing against Hertz Rent-A-Car, just first one of mine. I'm sure their cars are great. If I sue Hertz Rent-A-Car in a district court and they try to remove with that arbitration clause, not only would they not get to remove the case, there's no way a public court, there's no way any court would say, oh yeah, you guys go to settle the dispute against yourself by yourself. There's no way anybody would let, they'd probably sanction them, or at least they'd say this clause is unconscionable. They'd do that, pop, pop, exit out. So you see, that's where the law is everywhere else, except in two areas. One is Facebook, and Facebook is gonna fix that, and I salute them. And it's about time. And the other place, I had two fingers up. I don't want to flip off your friends here. So the other place. I'm not going to give the thumbs up on this. Speaking of things, the other place is the government of the United States and the states of the United States, where if you have a dispute against your government, you go to a government court. And that's not right. And I have a chapter in the book, Your Next Government, about citizen courts. And you should read that chapter if you agree with me that if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. If private parties don't get to settle disputes against themselves, why does the government get to decide disputes against itself? Now, you might say, well, but we got to have courts settle disputes. I mean, how else are we going to do it? And I say, hello, private arbitration. So I propose If I have a constitutional claim against the government of, say, the United States, government of the United States, you're infringing my First Amendment rights, stop it. I should be able to take it to a body formed in the same way that private parties form fair panels for deciding their disputes. We just, again, we take it off the shelf, Denise, to use your beautiful phrase. And the way other institutions, like, you know, big private corporations settle their disputes in private arbitration is, if you got a French and a German company and they have a fight, they don't use Germans or French to settle the dispute. They tried that and it resulted in a couple wars. No, they do something like this. The German company says, I choose that arbitrator. She's trusted, qualified, she's taken an oath of independence. And the French company says, well, we choose that guy. And those two arbitrators choose a third arbitrator. And we have a panel of three arbitrators in that nobody can say is unfair. And that's how we ought to do our fights with the government. But back to Facebook. I don't want to get too far afield. It's the same problem. And Facebook is going to fix it. and in a way, we're going to be able then, those of us who are aware of this issue, to kind of say to the governments elsewhere, hey, look, even Facebook got on board. When you fight Facebook about, hey, Facebook, you shut me off. What the heck? You can't do that, Facebook. Facebook doesn't get to make the call all on their own. Well, we decided to cut you off from your livelihood. Poof, that's our decision. That's crazy. You got to have an outside party. I'm surprised that no clever attorney has started litigating this with Facebook already. Clever attorneys listening right now, I see an opportunity. If there's any money to be had, you should go after that clause, the mechanism, whatever Facebook is doing, where they are deciding the fates of the people they are harboring without any independent review, that's unconscionable. It's got to stop. I'm glad they're fixing it. I'm saying about time. And if they drag their heels, you guys should sue them or something. It's not good. They need to change it.
Well, there certainly are plenty of lawyers that have had no reluctance to sue Facebook over the years. So,
all right.
You're probably right that some enterprising person will seize on this.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it more. It's actually more of a defense than an independent claim, but let's not get into the weeds. Somebody will figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it goes back to the point that Facebook is a huge institution that's in some ways acting like a government in people's lives, but it's not. It's still a private party. It gets to make its own, it gets to have its own ecosystem. It gets to enforce its rules. You know, that's what our system, our capitalist system of government lets it do.
To a point, right?
Yeah.
Facebook, under law of the United States, and I think almost everywhere, in fact, other places are even less forgiving of private arbitration in the United States. You know, Facebook, no private party is going to be able to enforce a clause that says, in disputes between me, private party, and you, private individual, I alone get to settle, you know, those disputes. No outside court will enforce that clause and allow Facebook, for example, to remove the case from the public court. So there will always be over. That's one thing the private institutions cannot do, should not do. And that's why it's so shocking that Facebook is only now, that one, they haven't been called on this. And two, they're only just now figuring it out on their own. Oh, God, maybe we should have, you know, afford some independent review of our dispute resolution mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so fascinated with how that's all going to play out and how they implement it. So we will continue to take a look. You mentioned the chapter that you've written. Is the forthcoming book called The Forecast for Anarchy, or is that the title of your chapter?
It's a chapter in the book. And the book is The Routledge Guide to Anarchy, I think. Sorry, I don't quite remember the title of the book. It's forthcoming.
So it seems like this is a good opportunity. We've been talking about some things that are already existing in the world now. It seems like your chapter here sort of gazes more into the future and forecasts what may come. And as you say, the title is rather provocative, but why don't you explain why you think that anarchy is in our future?
Yes. And as I said, I don't really care for that word much, anarchy. It means a lot of things to different people. So let's say instead stateless societies, or if I slip into saying anarchy, we're talking about societies or institutions that are stateless. And what is a state? A state is, I'm using Max Weber's definition, which is pretty standard. He was a sociologist. It is, to paraphrase, it's an institution that credibly claims a monopoly on the justified use of coercive force within a territorial area. Okay? Justifiably claims a monopoly. They don't always exercise it. They often say, states often say, you have a a right to self-defense. So you can use coercive force, people under our jurisdiction, but they claim monopoly, but that's our call. We could take it away, as they've largely done in Britain. Those poor sheep. But anyhow, so that's a state. And we're talking about mechanisms, societies, things that are stateless. And I'll say right now, in that sense of anarchy, we most of the time, the best parts of our lives are anarchistic, right? It's like you have Thanksgiving dinner with you and your friends and family, and that's no, there's no rules. There's nobody walking around with a badge. You do these things because you love each other. You care for each other. You have fun together. At your workplace, you do the things you do because there's somebody with a badge over in the corner tapping a baton. No, you do it because you care about your job, and these are the people you work with, and you have exchanging obligations, whatever. Once in a great while, though, the state suddenly becomes at the, a very pointed issue, and you violate the law, and they come to arrest you. But most of the time, our lives are anarchistic, and the better for it. Now, back to the forecast. In this chapter, I actually venture a forecast. I don't put any money down, but I actually wasn't sure I wanted to do this, and I did do it. I made a forecast, and I said, around the year 2030, there's going to be a lot of political turbulence, and we're going to see basically a popping of the statist bubbles, right? I view the state now as kind of in a bubble economy. I remember earlier we said I view all this as we're talking about governing services. And right now, the governing services industry is provided in part by monopoly providers, states, and then non-monopoly providers, all these private jurisdictions and all kinds of institutions, homeowners associations, kind of run little governments and things like that. Online, we have governments too. So the statist bubble is going to pop around 2030. And I get this from financial forecasts laid out in the chapter. I don't do this work myself. I just say, because it's not news really to most people who are paying attention, that there's unsustainable forecasts ahead. Unless we radically change the way a government is financed in the United States around 2030, the bad stuff's going to hit the fan, and that's going to result in a number of big changes relatively quickly. Part of the goal of this chapter is to give us a heads up. It's a little bit like whitewater rafting. If you've never seen what's around the bend and it gets rough, you're in trouble. If you know the route, or at least can see ahead, you can maybe make it okay. And that's what I'm trying to do here, is give us a lay of this turbulent stretch ahead. So 2030, around then. And what we're going to see is basically the collapsing of the financing of governments. That could manifest itself in a number of ways. I don't think it's going to be especially violent, because I think instead of like one big pop, what we're going to see is kind of foam. It's like when you make a nice lather, you're washing your hands at the sink, you got a lot of bubbles, and you rinse it off in the water. And those bubbles are popping, but it's not disastrous. And that's the nice thing about all these mini jurisdictions. They're kind of like diffusing governance. So we're going to actually see them taking up a lot of the load off of the shoulders of traditional governments, so that the effective scope of traditional states is going to shrink. It's their roles in our lives. For example, if we move over transactions, I don't actually think it'll be Bitcoin. That's another topic. I've been working on some legal attacks to Bitcoin and other permissionless networks, which have me terribly worried, but I can't deny they seem to be very plausible threats. I'm not advocating them. I'm just saying these are credible threats to Bitcoin and other permissionless networks. But I do think it will be something like cryptocurrencies that will allow people to exit from traditional fiat money. And it'll have huge ramifications on the financing of traditional governments. Around 2030, though, that's when it'll be like, last call. And states will – that'll be the KT boundary for states. The KT boundary marks the end of the dinosaurs and the kind of rise of the mammals, and that's going to be for us around 2030 for governments. And dinosaurs didn't go away, and states are not going to go away, but after this boundary, they're not going to be the big lumbering beasts that currently threaten our lives. There's still people, mostly guys – I almost said guys. It probably is mostly guys with their fingers hovering over the buttons of nuclear weapons. We got to get rid of that. That could kill us all. That's crazy. And we're going to fix that if we make it to 2030. And how's it going to happen? Well, the chapter goes into that. I'll just stop there. I've given you a date and risked a prediction and given you a metaphor of the popping of bubbles. So it's not – it's more like we're going to wash our hands of government. That's how those bubbles are going to pop, and we'll be better for it.
So do you feel like that will happen on a global scale?
Basically, yeah, except it depends, of course. The globe is huge. And I care about, because most people live under, the big governments. But certainly Western Europe, United States, I believe China also. The forecast I looked at, I believe they include China and Japan. They all basically have the same pressures. It comes in different forms and different strengths, but all of them are overextended. And the reason, Denise, is in the very nature of statism for it to create these bubbles, because it's a really crummy way to run an economy. Pushing people around is very inefficient. And to the extent we can use more efficient mechanisms for coordinating our behavior, that's what we're talking about. Is how do we all get along? How do we like not step in each other's toes? And giving one person a badge and a baton, it turns out, is a really crummy way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they always collapse eventually.
I could definitely see what you're describing evolve the way you've described it, and think your timing is probably reasonable. But I'm wondering, when this happens, if we have all these private government zones, how does anything get done? I mean, not everything's going to have the same off-the-shelf OS. So if, one municipality 20 miles away from another municipality has a totally different system of government, and the state has receded to such a point where it can't really mandate uniformity between the two. I mean, you really are talking about anarchy.
I think there is a risk of chaos, anarchy in the form of chaos. And it's bad practice to lower your head and pretend that's not a risk. There are even black swans. Whenever you hit turbulent times, there's risks that we're not even, you and me, nobody is thinking about. The societies are more vulnerable in times of great change to those kinds of dread risks. So I'm not pretending it's going to be easy. And it's a forecast, right? It's not like train tracks. It's more like when you're going to get there. It's more like pointing in that direction, saying there's a pass over there. Good luck through the brush. But I think the best way to think about it is to recur to the analogy of computers. Remember, we talked about code is code, but let's take it a little broader than computers. Let's talk about telecommunication networks. Some ancestor of mine got this whole Bell system thing started, and it used to be that was our telecommunication network. There's some awesome things about that, which we gave up, but whatever. I got to say, using packet switch networks is really a lot better for a lot of applications versus a circuit switch network. So your basic state is like a circuit switch network. A circuit switch network is different from a packet switch network like the internet, in that there is one line that connects two points. And if somebody steps in there with scissors and snips the line, you lose the communication. Whereas a packet switch network is more robust. And point is, the analogy is, the transition we're seeing is rather like the transition from circuit-switched telecommunication networks to packet-switched ones. That's what we're going to kind of see around 2030. That analogy suggests, and by the way, and the analogy does hold up, because back in the world of, say, we'll say 1950 through like early 90s, there was like in most of the world, there were telecommunications was basically only done through circuit switching, and they were connected, these systems, only at the borders. If you want to make a call to the Ukraine in 1970, you didn't just pick up your phone and do it. It just didn't work that way. And you could maybe call somebody in England. It worked, okay. But there was some stuff that had to happen at the borders. So that's the world we live in with states, right? We kind of have – it's exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're going to see is a transition from, as we saw, from circuit switch networks to packet switch networks. I'm sure there was some turbulence. There's no risk of nuclear war there, so you know. The risks of dire results were lower. But still, we worked it out, and we ended up are in this world where we have packet-switched systems of different flavors, which largely communicate through their borders in pretty efficient ways. It's not perfect. Once in a while, I want to read a Twitter. I'm not on Twitter. Not signed up. I just don't want to mess with it. But once in a while, there's something on I want to read, and I can't read it. Or, it's like a different protocol. I can't get access. Not the end of the world. And that's what the world would be like for us after 2030, if we're lucky, and things work out like I think they might. Basically, each of us will have a contractual commitment to one or more governing systems, probably or more. I might have a contract with a region that provides national defense of a certain sort and natural disaster preparedness. And then I'm also a member of a homeowners association, which regulates very finely my detailed way of my behavior. It tells me when I can put out my garbage can and when I can't. But it's all contractual. And once in a while, I get fed up with one arrangement and I make it with some other party. And it's just a matter of like going online, and I probably use some kind of tokenized economy to choose the new option. That's not chaos. It's complicated. It doesn't always work. Tanzania might be a little slow. They might be stuck with circuit-switched networks for a while. For a long time, just like dinosaurs survived in the big lunky form for a long while, some of them, there's still going to be states around. It's going to be interesting. I recommend you read, for a number of reasons, I recommend you read Neal Stephenson. Is one of my favorite authors, and I cite him in this paper. A whole section of this chapter is, let's see what people who write really entertaining works of fiction say about a possible future of government. And it turns out you get fantastic stories. And Neal Stephenson, Snow Crash, Diamond Age, even Cryptonomicon has some of this stuff going on. That man has a vision of the future, which I borrowed from liberally.
Yeah, love Neal Stephenson as well. The final thing I want to hit before we let you go today is you mentioned cryptocurrencies and their growing role in our society. But they too, I mean, you talked about there are train tracks and you're going to hit some brush along the way. They've definitely been hitting the brush and partially in the form of things being put on the blockchain that folks don't expect to be there that can corrupt or ruin the experience. You mentioned to me in an email there a story that just came out this week. Why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. It's not the first time it's happened, but it's it's just the most recent example of people putting on publicly accessible, permissionless networks. In this case, it was the SVC chain. It's Bitoshi SV. Yeah. Bitcoin SV, Bitcoin Satoshi version. Money Button runs an interface with it, and somebody used that service to put on that blockchain some child porn. And any permissionless network is going to let people upload whatever they want to upload. Now, Bitcoin itself doesn't leave you much room to store images like, you know, child porn, but Ethereum does give people a lot more room. People have likened these blockchain networks to public bulletin boards. Quite true. And more than that, they're like public bulletin boards where once it's up there, you can't take it down, which for freedom of speech is awesome in a way. And for historical accuracy is great. And for, of course, for cryptocurrency, for spending, you got to have it. But it also means if some creep goes up there and slaps up a piece of child porn, you can't take it down unless what? Unless you do a hard fork. So basically what we see here is, I don't like this myself. I got some money in Bitcoin, I will say. And I wish I could say, you know, it's going to be awesome. I'm going to be able to retire on that. But I got to admit, this has me worried. There are solutions. And the solutions, in brief, all involve governance. Not governments, but governance. And what this means is, for these networks to protect themselves from legal attacks premised on the unauthorized distribution of blockchain databases that include illicit data, such as but not limited to child porn, you could also have copyright infringing data. You could have trade secrets that don't belong there. You could have, in some countries, religiously prohibited images. There's lots of ways to make people upset with data. So if these online permissionless systems don't figure out a way to deal with that, they're going to have to hard fork, or they're going to be having fights with every local government that can find what? Somebody hosting a full node of Bitcoin. You know, if you're hosting a full node of Bitcoin, a full Bitcoin node, and you know there's copyright infringing stuff on there, child porn, you've received the notice, you know that there's trade secrets on there. Somebody's going to be knocking and you're going to have arguments, but I can't guarantee that you'll get out of it. And I actually, at this moment, think you're in deep trouble if you do that.
Do you think that this brush is thick enough that it could derail some of these networks, or that they'll get through it?
There's a number of things could happen. I mean, I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong in a way. A lot of my friends, Chad Albertaski, I just mentioned him earlier. Mm-hmm. I want them to succeed. That's one reason I got worried about this. I started thinking about my friends in trouble. So I could be wrong. There's that. There could be legal reforms. There's that. It could be. There's a chance lawmakers will say, well, this is effed up. This is messing up blockchain. We got to fix copyright law and child porn law and trade secret law and defamation law. It could happen. Maybe. Maybe this will somehow be tied up in that 2030, you know, bubbles popping thing. It could be some complex interaction of states saying we can't stand this blockchain and we have traditional legal tools to shut it down, and people running blockchain saying, all right, now you're getting really annoying. We're throwing the switch. Maybe that's how it'll happen. Or this is actually the last opportunity kind of out from this, if I'm right, and it's a problem, and states actually act on their traditional laws and they start lowering the booms, the solution will be a couple things. One, you have to hard fork to get rid of the garbage that's on there. But it's still relatively early in, you know, the history of Ethereum and Bitcoin and all these other blockchains. So this is an early hard lesson. And it's just one more hard fork, really, for most of them. So you have to do a hard fork to do a fresh start. And when you do that fresh start, what you got to have, friends? Governance. You got to have a system in place where if an authorized representative of an authority with guns that can come and shoot the people running your full nodes comes up and knocks on the door and says, your blockchain has some very bad stuff on it, you got to be able to say, we'll stop it, rewind, we got rid of the junk, are we good now, statist? And the statist will say, okay, and walk away. And then you can start business again. You can't do that now because we don't have the systems of governance in place. If you create those systems of governance, you got a shot. You got a shot. You still got to have cooperative statists. But I think they're under existing law. We're very close to something like that with DMCA Title II. At least you could do, you could settle. I think the worst problem is copyright. I am a copyright guy. Another one of my books, I have it here, is Intellectual Privilege. So if you like copyright, you should read about it in my book, Intellectual Privilege. And it's available free online. Yeah. PDF form.
Cool.
So copyright's the worst threat to blockchains, but DMCA Title II, the notice and takedown provisions used by Google, YouTube, et cetera, to kind of not have copyright wreck their networks, their databases, we could easily extend that to, I think, Ethereum, Bitcoin, and other networks. I almost said permissionless, but here's the thing. You could still make them permissionless maybe, but you got to have something to rewind. We got to formalize the forking process. Or you can institute, I think this is actually where we're headed, permission-full systems, systems that are not, that are permissioned. Mm-hmm. And there's different flavors of that. It doesn't mean we have to do like an iris scan and a fingerprint, you know, every time we get online. Maybe it'll just be robust pseudonyms. Maybe that's the way to do it. It's just robust pseudonyms. We can have virtual personae, which act as buffers between our real selves and Amazon and everybody else online. And those are robust over time and can have assets and reputations and things like that. And they will participate in this online governance. And that will keep the statists from shutting down blockchains.
So you're suggesting that there could be, and again, this would come from, you know, a traditional state legislature or maybe a new kind of privatized state rulemaking body, where part of enabling a blockchain-based currency to thrive would be a notice and takedown system like the DMCA. If there's something bad there, they have a safe harbor, they take it down, they, you know, police their network that way, but they're somewhat shielded from personal liability.
Yes, that's well put, Denise. And the more I think about it, the more I like that. I only just got into this. This is like my latest new project. And I like that analogy in part because really YouTube is kind of permissionless, you know, in a way. Basically, we can upload anything we want, but they kick it back if they don't like it. So that's kind of nice. You know, open access is a good thing. As long as you don't, in that span, cause permanent damage. That's really something you got to think about, especially with some of the stuff that is at risk here. So it's complicated.
It is. And I for one, I'm not entirely sure that I think that governments are going to continue to permit these currencies to thrive and expand and diversify in the way that they have in the last few years. I think, you know, there are plenty of governments around the world who view cryptocurrencies as a pretty big threat. I don't know that I say, you know, blockchain technologies in general are probably more likely to thrive, but Some of the cryptocurrencies, I think, are at least, you know, what are there? More than 2,500 of them now. Wow. I think that the SEC and other entities looking at initial coin offerings and that kind of thing are probably going to put some controls in that we're not seeing yet, so that things will be a bit constricted and not as Wild West as they have been. But, you know, it is a fascinating ecosystem to pay attention to, and I'm glad that you are doing so. So any final thoughts about that before we sign off for the day?
Well, I'll emphasize again, I'm not speaking for any client, and I'll emphasize again, I'm not advocating these kinds of activities. I don't want people to put bad stuff on publicly accessible blockchains, and I, for the most part, don't want authorities messing with blockchains, although I got to say, if they're being used to do illicit activities, that could be justified. I'll just stop with that.
Okay. Tom W. Bell, it has been so interesting to chat with you here today. Thank you so much for making the time to join us here on Triangulation. Is there anything going on at Chapman or anything else that you would like to highlight for our listeners and viewers today before we sign off?
It's always great things going on at Chapman here in the heart of Orange County, with inside of Disneyland and today's snow-capped mountains. I love it here. But I do want to say, because you told me I could, Denise, I will be sending to you and through you, your watchers, some links if they want to see some videos. I have a short video on ULEX I can send, very digestible. A long-form video on basically everything in your next government. And and I'll make those available in case you didn't see enough of my face here.
Yes, and just a reminder, we've been talking about it a lot on the show today, but Tom W. Bell's book, Your Next Government, From the Nation State to Stateless Nations, is available for your perusal at your convenience on your platform of choice. It doesn't have to be Amazon, but it's available
And
there.
Write a review. Please write reviews.
Yes.
On Amazon, I got to admit, it's a huge market. I really want to have reviews there.
All right, cool. Well, we'll encourage people to do that. And it's been just so nice chatting with you here today. I'm glad we got to do this.
Likewise, Denise, thank you. And thank you also to your listeners and viewers.
Folks, thank you so much for joining us here on Triangulation. We want to let you know that we record this show, of course, Fridays at 11:30 a.m. Pacific time, 2:30 p.m. Eastern time. And you can watch live at twit.tv/live as we do that. We also want to remind you that we do an annual survey here at the Twit Network, and it is available for you now to please participate in. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, what you listen to, et cetera, et cetera. It is at twit.to/survey19. We would love to hear from you. We want to serve you better. And the way that we can do that is to get your take on our offerings here at the network. So head on over to twit.to/survey19 and be heard, please. And of course, you can subscribe to this show at twit.tv/triangulation. We're so glad that you've joined us here today, and we'll see you next time on Triangulation. Take care.